I have
current geek.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Current Geek. This is Current Geek, the weekly proceedings of the meetings of the Frog Pants All-Stars, geeks of the world and you, to keep you current on all things that matter most. I'm Scott Johnson. Here's Tom Merritt.
Hey, did you cut your jib?
I cut my jib. You like the cut of my jib? You do?
Yeah.
Okay. Is it jib or gib?
Well, it depends. the originator of the jib calls it gib, but the internet prefers to call it jib, so there's kind of a fight over it.
What did Andy Jib call himself? Was it Andy Gib or Andy Jib, I wonder?
Well, there were two Bs, so that makes it a hard G.
All right.
Well, in Australia.
Well, we have an Easy B coming right up, folks. Easy B is his nickname. We have a guest on the
Easy B got the eight ball rolling in the nickel dime.
Wow. That's pretty good.
I'm less comfortable with that than I thought I would be.
Pretty impressed. On the line with us, we have the creator of Mission Pick and an all-around good guy and someone in the community and someone who should have been on the show a long time ago, and I don't know what took us so long. Ladies and gentlemen, it's Brett Rounsville. Brett, welcome to the show.
Hi, guys.
Good to see you, man.
Yeah,
it's good to have you here.
I also like your gibs.
Oh, thanks. So, like, back in the Quake days, when you'd blow a character up, they always said you blow up their gibs, and then people started calling them jibs, and they were supposed to be the chunks of body that would fly everywhere, and I could never get around to that thinking, so it's always GIFs, jibs, Andy Gib, cut of my jib, and the rock of Gibraltar. There you go.
I'm all about GIF, but jib makes sense to me because they're like little giblets, right?
Yeah, I think that's
big giblets. I guess a giblet is a little one. They're
jibs. Giraffe, obviously. We all say giraffe.
Giraffe. Geronimo.
And giant. For very large things.
Yeah, for the largest GIF.
Yeah, ginormous.
You want ginormous GIFs.
I wonder what percentage of ants are guy ants. thing that we know.
You know, we ask the hard questions here on Current Geek, and we also run down the top nerd stories of the week by playing this first.
Herbert Hoover, Secretary of Commerce in 1922, finds infant radio facilitates news gathering, as do many others in high public office.
All right, Tom, it's all up to you now.
Well, Scott, Marvel says they're going to produce a sixth series for Netflix. Don't forget they have Luke Cage, Iron Fist, The Defenders, Jessica Jones, and Daredevil. And now Punisher is getting his own series. Jon Bernthal will return to the role. And Steve Lightfoot, who had done Hannibal and Casualty, will be the writer and executive producer and serve as showrunner.
Am I supposed to resign from this show because I still haven't seen any of the new Daredevil episodes yet? Is that bad?
Holy cow, you're missing out.
Am I? Explain.
Well, thanks, everybody. That's the end of Current Geek.
Well, Brett, you're a fan, I guess. I love the first season. I just haven't gotten around to it. I've talked about it on the show, but I have this thing with Netflix where I know when it's their own stuff, when they've made an original programming, I know it's just always going to be there. So I just started House of Cards because there was other things that felt like they had shelf lives on them, and I just knew this stuff would never go. So that's my excuse, but... What am I missing? Why is it great, and why should he get his own spinoff?
That makes sense. I'm picking up what you're putting down, but I think I'm an even bigger fan of the Marvel TV shows than I am of the Marvel movies. Mm. Maybe with the exception of the Captain America coming out, but I am super psyched about any new Marvel TV shows. But I do have like a little bit of mixed feelings about this one. I have a little bit of a he's not my Punisher in me because I really dug the Thomas Jane Punisher.
Oh, wow.
I thought he was cool.
Yeah. Well, Bernthal, he's a little picky. He has a trailer, and then each of his earlobes have their own trailer, and it's expensive. It's hard, but
you mean like a highlight reel, like a trailer?
Yeah, that's it. No, the one where they go in
like just that's coming attractions of his ears.
I thought it was just as funny that way.
Yeah,
you know, it kind of works either way. My bad dad joke, but anyway, I guess good for Bernthal, congratulations, Jerry Conway, friend of the show who created The Punisher and who is very happy with this adaptation. For the first time, Jerry Conway has come out to say, I really like what they're doing with Punisher. He's never been able to say that before, even with Thomas Jane. So this is all very exciting. I can't wait. Bring it on. I guess I should watch the other one so I know why he's good, and then I'm all in for the next series, I guess.
Oh, yeah, totally. It is a solid series for sure.
All right.
Highly recommend.
No, absolutely. I recommend it too. I also really like Bernthal as the Punisher, and I don't have any past history to that colors my opinions other than Shane from The Walking Dead, which I hated. but I kind of knew Bernthal was not to blame for that. Yeah. And this definitely redeemed him in my eyes.
Well, did you bring any of that baggage to you? Did it take you like an episode or two to
He first walked out, I'm like, here's Shane. And I, first it kind of worked because I was like, well, the Punisher is a dick. Like he's a jerk, you know? So the Shane kind of fit, but then the character actually grew and had understandable motivations and depth. And I was like, oh, he is capable of doing that if you write it for him. That's awesome.
Yeah, that's good. Yeah. Well, grats to him. And that makes how many total now? So we got that. Six. We have Jessica Jones. Oh, six total, right? So who else? Who am I not thinking of then if it's...
Iron Fist.
Oh, and we're not
thinking of.
And we're not counting... are we counting Defenders? Or we are counting that. Okay.
The Defenders will be its own series.
Right.
It'll have all of them. And well, we don't actually know if Punisher will be in there, but it'd be kind of stupid for him not to at least bring him into an episode or two.
Yeah. If you're getting your own show, you're in the Defenders, I say.
The Daily Mail reported that Prince William, Duke of Cambridge, and Prince Henry of Wales may have filmed a small part as stormtroopers in Star Wars Episode 8. What was officially announced was that the princes went to have luncheon and a private tour of the set, but unnamed sources are saying they went straight into the outfits.
Wow.
Better or worse than when Prince Henry dressed up like a Nazi?
Better, because these are kind of Nazis, but they're sort of fake Nazis. You know what
I mean?
I
know, right? Like, same idea.
He's Prince Henry of Wales.
Kind of a known quantity, Prince Henry of Wales.
Point of order, Brett. He's Prince Henry of Wales, or you can colloquially refer to him as Prince Harry.
Oh. Ah, is that allowed? You can do that?
Yeah.
Okay.
Actually, because you're part of the United States, call him whatever you damn well please.
Yeah, that's right. I'm not subject to kings or queens.
Up like Hitler.
Yeah. Well, wait, is this the one that was in, this isn't the one that was in the Vegas doing that whole thing in Vegas, that big mess that happened, right? Where he showed his wiener and stuff.
Prince Harry has been to Vegas. Yes.
Okay. But one of them showed like his royal wiener on a camera and got in trouble.
Did he?
Yeah.
Did he?
Yeah. Didn't that happen? I swear that happened.
Has it been proven?
I thought it was
sure that was just a royal baby hand.
Was it?
I thought it was a thing, and it really happened, and he got all kinds of chided by Buckingham Palace. Yeah.
Did it prove it? No, you can't.
Royal baby holding an apple.
Good. Or something like that. Well, anyway, well, grats to them. I mean, how else are you going to get into a freaking Star Wars movie unless you live in Britain and you're a big deal, you know?
I mean, that is kind of the thing. Like, oh, you're the prince. Fine. Get in a stormtrooper outfit.
Yeah.
We heard our buddy Daniel Craig did it.
Yeah, that was confirmed, right? That really happened. He didn't.
Was it?
It's starting to feel like anyone that walks on the studio a lot gets to be a stormtrooper at some point.
I'm all down with that. Let's go to Britain. Let's go to Europe. This is where they always film those things.
It's actually kind of brilliant when you think about it. They don't have to pay any extras.
Yeah. But what I would want
they could make cash off of it. That's way better than Universal Studios.
I'll tell you what I would demand if I was royalty. I would demand that I get to keep the suit. Like, why? Fine, you're in the film for a couple of seconds, but I want to go home with like a dirty, used up looking stormtrooper suit.
Yeah,
that's bad.
I still thought you were talking about the Vegas story, and I got really worried.
It's a royal lightsaber.
Let's move on. IO9's Charlie Jane Anders blogged recently about the revelation from Chris Taylor's How Star Wars Conquered the Universe that the entire Star Wars saga was being told by R2-D2. Lucas apparently said this to animation director Rob Coleman on his first day of work on Episode 3, Revenge of the Sith. Lucas apparently said the entire story of Star Wars is actually being recounted to the keeper of the Journal of the Wills 100 years after the events of Return of the Jedi, and the person recounting it, or the droid recounting it, is R2-D2.
But can't you just say anything? Couldn't you say, oh, it's, I don't know.
Hey, Rob.
It's like the MODOK, or not MODOK. MODOK would be...
Two.
Yeah. It's, you know, you could say like Lobot from the gas planet is telling his brother this story. Like, you can say anything.
Okay, but Lobot is not in every single episode, and R2-D2 is, and R2-D2 is the only one in every single episode that actually remembers everything. He doesn't have his mind wiped.
But when he's off with Luke on Dagobah, and you got everybody else off doing their thing, getting caught on the gas planet there, hanging out with Lando, he doesn't know any of those things, does he?
He shows up, C-3PO tells him everything that's happened. Now, reliable narrator or not is what you're asking.
Yeah, I guess I am. Yeah, like, maybe not.
To his point, that does kind of mean if we don't care if the narrator is reliable or not, it really can just be anyone who's the narrator.
Yeah.
I strongly suspect that the narrator is George Lucas and J.J. Abrams.
I don't know, man. You're really going out on a limb here.
I love this idea that R2-D2 is there, because think of it too. What is R2 in every situation that he's key to? He's the hero, right? He's the one who actually like saves Anakin in episode one. He's the one that unlocks everything that needs to be unlocked in Empire Strikes Back. He's the one that opens the door and sacrifices himself in Return of the Jedi. Like, if you were telling the story, that's how you would tell it.
Yeah, I guess.
I mean, if I were telling the story in R2-D2 and I was R2-D2, I'd probably also leave out the parts where I like electrocute myself and the parts where I'm captured by a bunch of sand critters.
He's smart. He's like, well, I got to humanize myself, so I'll get captured, but it'll kind of look like it was C-3PO's fault, really. Like, I'll still come out.
So obsessed with humanization. It's embarrassing, really.
He's got to droidize himself, I guess. I don't know.
Well, whatever, man. We got to anthropomorphize everything.
What's the key to episode 8? Oh, R2-D2 has woken up and he's found the map. He's the hero. He's the hero of every story.
Well, he asked BB-8 what went down, right? Like, what'd you do all day, roly-poly robot? Oh, I did all these things. And he said, all right, imagine it to this story I'm telling 100 years from now.
Yep.
There you go.
I think if R2-D2 were the narrator of episode 7, everything we saw would be prologue. And then like, yeah, and these guys tried to do whatever. And then finally I woke up and saved the day.
Well, there's
like the movie is starting there.
R2-D2's telling the story to the author of the Journal of the Wills, who balances things back out.
And the idea is that he's a bit of a mischievous robot, so maybe he's stretching some truths, but you'll notice that he always, if this is indeed from his point of view, he's putting himself in the story in always the goofiest ways. He's the one getting swallowed by a swamp creature and vomited back out and screaming as he flies through the air. He's the one that is making silly sounds, and the jokiest moments of Star Wars past seem to happen right around R2-D2. So that's an interesting point of view to, you know, I guess he's self-effacing.
He's not telling the story. It's just that he's the one who tells the story to the person who creates it from a...
So we have multiple unreliable narrators.
Exactly.
Playing telephone.
I'm just saying, if you were doing it, like if Brett was the narrator, he would put himself, he'd paint himself in the best possible light. He would be less of a goofball and more of a, you know, oh, look at the heroic guy in the corner or whatever.
And to Brett's, maybe.
Yeah.
You say that, but then lots of people tell like honest stories about goofy stuff they've done. You know, that's kind of the whole thing about comedians and memoirs. Look at the mistakes that I made. Right. That's
morning podcasts. I
mean, it's an interesting idea.
Like unreliable narrator. It's that. Almost as if maybe this didn't happen exactly the way it's been done.
You think? He's also, don't forget before we move on, he's the same guy that said that, Han shot first, or no, he said that Greedo shot first, so they had to fix it, but then told a bunch of other people that no, Han shot first. Like he retcons everything, and it's fine. It's his direct con. I'm fine with it.
That's the Journal of the Wills author that's doing that.
Yeah.
He goes back and gives you the revised journal.
Yeah. I want to see that guy. He's all CGI.
The St. James version.
All right. Canada Post has been rolling out a series of Star Trek themed stamps in honor of Star Trek's 50th anniversary. The latest stamp features an image of Dr. Leonard Bones McCoy. Damn it, Jim. He's a doctor, not a stamp, but now he's a stamp. DeForest Kelly, obviously, the person who portrayed Bones. It's not the new Bones. Stamps with Kirk and Spock have already been revealed. One more stamp in the set is yet to be revealed and is said to feature a little known Canadian connection.
Oh, I'll bet it's Scotty then. Because he's Canadian.
Well, no, because they mentioned that in the article. Like, he's from Vancouver, and they made a big deal. Like, this is a little-known Canadian connection.
Hmm. How is Bones not already the least-known Canadian connection? Is there anything at all that has to do with Canada?
Well, no, they're not saying that every one of these people has a Canadian connection. They're saying the next one is a little-known Canadian. Because, I don't think Leonard McCoy...
So they don't all have to have Canadian connections.
No.
Right.
Just the next one has a slight Canadian connection, so they're crowing about it.
Yeah.
Maybe they're like, all right, yeah, his name is DeForest Kelly, and yeah, he was born in Georgia, but his character's name was Leonard McCoy. But he also went by Bones, and all Canadians have Bones.
I love it. Canadians have Bones. That's a good one.
William Shatner, obviously Canadian connection.
Right.
No, there's no Spock Canadian connection either.
No, he's from
here. They just want to do Star Trek. That's fine.
Yeah.
Well, they did mention in the
why do you want to take
Vulcan,
that away from
the
them?
City of Canada? I feel like that's a little Canadian connection.
Right?
Maybe they'll end up just being Paul Schaefer in like a Star Trek uniform, and then they'll say, ah, gotcha, he's Canadian, get it? And then they'll say sorry.
It'll be, it'll be Peter Jennings interviewing Paul Schaefer about Star Trek.
I'm just brilliant. Still. I'm all into that. Freaking sign me up, man.
Okay, enough about Star Wars, Trek, or other star-related things. Let's talk about sea monkeys.
Yeah.
New York Times Magazine has an in-depth report about the fight Yolanda Signorelli von Braunhut, a real name.
Who, by the way, is actually the villain in the upcoming Captain America.
And has a startling Canadian connection. She is waging a legal fight with Big Time Toys, also the real name of the company, over the right to her husband, Harold von Braunhut's invention, nay, discovery, sea monkeys, also known as brine shrimp. Von Braunhut accuses Big Time of breach of contract and trademark infringement. Big Time claims that von Braunhut illegally terminated her contract with them. And Big Time now purchases their brine shrimp from China instead of, as previously agreed, directly from von Braunhut, based on the original line of sea monkeys that her late husband devised.
What the crap? I cannot believe this is a thing in 2016. This is blowing my mind.
This is my favorite story of the day. I loved everything.
Oh my gosh, it's amazing. Did you read the New York Times Magazine article?
Yeah, I read the whole thing. I was totally enthralled, and I was like dead set on this becoming like an epic TV series about von Braunhut, or like three movie trilogy. Until we got to the part where it turns out he's also a Nazi.
It's really fun saying von Braunhut, by the way. I'm worried if you say von Braunhut loud enough, horses will whine somewhere.
It's funny. His character has changed a lot since his first appearance in, I want to say, Spider-Man number 43 in 1967.
Old von Braunhut. Real two-dimensional villain.
The other part that's awesome about this article is that Yolanda Signorelli von Braunhut lives in a sprawling mansion on acres and acres of land, but she doesn't have enough money to pay for water or electricity. So she just cooks on a camping stove in one room of her sprawling mansion. Yeah.
It's a little bit Grey Gardens.
Yeah, a little bit.
Like, the whole story is genuinely great. I would highly recommend going and finding the story on the New York Times. Yeah. The guy, like the original von Braunhut, whose actually name was just Braunhut, he changed it because he didn't like being Jewish. He wanted to sound more German. Mm-hmm. He invented like every stupid toy you've ever seen in the back of a comic book. It's an amazing story.
Yeah, totally worth checking out. And
X-ray specs, this guy.
Oh, yeah. Fake vomit, this guy. Well, I don't know about that. Maybe not that.
Sure, why not?
Liquid smoke, this guy.
No, but he really did invent the X-ray specs. Like, the majority of what's in the back of a comic book in the 80s. Von Braunhut.
I owe him a lawsuit then, because that stuff never freaking worked. None of it. I ordered that stuff when I was a kid. Those glasses didn't do anything. They didn't do nothing.
That's
for
all
me.
In the story too. It draws so many parallels between him and P.T. Barnum, and I just like I only wanted more information after I read this. It was really good.
All right, there you have it. Great story.
Did either of you ever have sea monkeys?
Oh yeah, yeah. It's, and again, another underwhelming purchase. Like, you get those things and you're expecting the cartoon to come to life where these look like, I don't know, the Who people from Whoville from a Dr. Seuss book. And instead, I don't even know what I was looking at. It's just like, it's dirty seawater.
Hybrid.
Yeah.
I only ever saw them in comic books until we went to Our Lady of the Snows Shrine and Convent in Southern Illinois. And we're in the gift shop. And amongst the rosaries and Pope John Paul II cards, they were selling sea monkey kits. It was the only time I ever saw them available on a shelf.
Right beneath the sign that said, "Have you ever wanted to feel like God?"
But wait, were they themed? Like little convent monkeys?
No, just stock sea monkey kits. Okay. Like, I guess like, you know, here. You too can control life.
I want like little I want little Benedictine monks that make cheese or something. That'd be I'd buy that.
Sea monk.
Yeah. Oh, good job.
You want cheese monkeys.
Cheese monkey.
Nailed it.
Aerospace engineer Zachary Howard has designed something he calls a synesthesia mask that will let you smell colors. A sensor at your fingertip registers the color, and then an Intel Edison chip breaks the color into its RGB values and stimulates three scent reservoirs in proportion to the amount of color detected. In his mask, red is grapefruit, green is tea tree, and blue is somewhat awkwardly lavender. Howard has made the plans available, though, so you can build it yourself and use whatever scents you want.
Yeah, but isn't the point of knowing what colors smell like that there's a baseline of what they smell like? This just seems like I'm going to assign, you know, I could blindfold my kids and go, all right, we're going to smell what yellow smells like. Oh, it's like yeah. lemons, Dad. Like, you're just faking them out, right?
Pretty arbitrary. And I feel like he went through way too many hoops to get to this arbitrary point. Like, why do you need all that technology when, like, I already have my wife squirting scented oils in my face all the time?
So let me get this straight, old man Brett and old man Scott. Yeah. Your problem with this is that the colors won't be accurately scented, and it's a lot of trouble to do this.
Well, look at I'm going to pull up
you're
the actual
freaking
headline.
Smelling things with your fingers.
You're not.
Colors.
You're actively.
You can retrain your brain to be like, that's red, and not even look at it because you can smell it.
It says right here, incredible DIY synesthesia mask gives you the ability to smell colors. That implies that colors intrinsically have a smell to begin with, and that this would let us discover what those smells are.
I don't think they'll smell right. The red won't smell right.
All it is, it's like, you know those air fresheners that they give you for free when you get your car washed?
Yeah.
It's like they gave you one of those, but it's activated only by certain colors. Like, you just, like, if you walk by a gray wall, suddenly you get shot in the face.
Well, gray would be the stinkiest, because that would just send most of the scents.
Yeah, that's where I'd get off. Ugh.
It's just a way of tricking your brain into changing how it perceives things. I think that's pretty crazy.
That I mean, in all honesty, that is kind of cool. Like, and I also like the idea of you could convince somebody, or if you did this, I don't know how you'd have to do it to make it work. Maybe they have to be younger, or I don't know. But if you could make it so that anytime anybody saw the color red, their brain essentially reminded you and you could sort of smell that smell again. Like, that'd be really interesting recall. And we do that all the time. Yeah. Like, I'll smell, you know, I can't smell like wet wood, like wood that's got rain and like been in the rain for a long time, or soaked kind of wood. I can't smell that smell without thinking of this dead cat we found once in an old cellar. Wow. that had fallen in on itself because of rain. And so we found this dead cat in there, and I'll never forget it. It's not that the smell is like dead cat smell. It's just I remember that cat and everything smelling that way. So if I smell that now, I go, dead cat. And, you know, why not whatever these are?
You could retrain your brain to just go, red.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, if you just strapped a mask to your 2-year-old for the next, like, 3 years or so, and you could set off like a lavender scent at any given time, what would you most want to connect your 2-year-old to lavender?
I don't know. See, this is where now he's starting to play God a little bit, right? Now we're starting to like mess with their psyche and give them all sorts of triggers. I don't know if I want to do that, but
every time you say sea monkeys, they smell lavender.
Yeah, I know when I was a parent of 2-year-olds, I would have liked lavender to fill the room every time they crap their diaper. That'd have been great, but that doesn't happen. We don't live in that mystery world.
I think this is pretty crazy. It's not terribly practical, but it's an attempt, in all honesty.
Maybe we could do that with this mask. Maybe every time you see the color brown, you would get squirted with lavender.
I like it. Yeah. I like it.
What Zachary Howard was trying to do is, like, synesthesia is a real condition that people have. Yeah. And he was like, this is your closest chance to be able to understand what they experience without dropping acid.
There you go.
Right. Netflix and the BBC are teaming up on a new 4-part CGI adaptation of Richard Adams' Watership Down. James McAvoy, John Boyega, Sir Ben Kingsley, Gemma Arterton, Nicholas Hoult, and more are in the cast. It arrives on both platforms, Netflix and BBC, simultaneously sometime in 2017. Haven't given us a fixed date.
So that's 2 X-Men. That's a Star Wars guy. That's Gandhi / you'll never see me coming. That guy.
Mm-hmm.
I was trying to think of his name and I can't.
That's pretty good.
Yeah.
Trevor.
That's great.
Mandarin.
Yeah, it's exactly the Mandarin. There you go. I always smell Mandarin when I. Anyway.
Every time I smell Ben Kingsley.
When you see Ben Kingsley color.
What is the color? What is the smell of Ben Kingsley? This sounds great. I'm all in on this. So bring it. And I also like that it's Netflix, so it'll always be there and I can delay watching
never
it.
Never watch it.
Yeah, never actually see it. No, but I'm a big fan of the original story. What was I don't remember who did the 2D animated thing forever ago, but I remember that really affected me when I was a kid, way into it.
And they say they're going to tone down the violence from that one, which that's sort of the point of the story, really.
Yeah, you take out what's it like? It's like finding out. Oh, I know what it was. Somebody the other day was saying, I was on a podcast, guesting on a podcast, and they had said, what if they're adapting, you know, the Dark Tower series to film, and there's been all this casting news. So you got Idris Elba in the part of Roland Deschain, and you have McConaughey as the Man in Black, and you have, Jesse Pinkman, I guess, is probably going to play Eddie, which is all seems like really good casting. And then they were talking about casting and all these questions about whitewashing Hollywood and all this other stuff. They were talking about casting a white actress in the role of, I forgot her name. Crap. Anyway, the one in the wheelchair.
Detta.
There you go. Detta. And they said, well, why would that be such a big deal? If we're going to go ahead and make Idris Elba the main character, why can't we do that with her? My point was, well, just from a straight up, if that's all we knew about her, that she was this person in a wheelchair and came to this other dimension, fine. But there's that really big backstory about her past and racial divides and how that affected her when she was young and as she grew up. Like, that's intrinsic to the character and the story. So I would compare that to this, not trying to evoke the national, you know, conversation about race every 5 minutes, but it's not that different here. The violence in Watership Down is kind of akin to that. That stuff is part of the fabric of the story, and without it, the impact of the story kind of goes away. I mean, I don't think we're asking for anything too ridiculous, but just a little, you know, a little trueness to the story would be all right. The problem is in America, especially in America,
you ask the producers, they're going to tell you we are going to absolutely be true to the story just for a modern sensibility. And I fear that guts the story. Like, you need to, if you can't go as far as they did in 1978 when they did this, then I don't know that you're really telling the same story.
I just think people are afraid to make cartoons, quote unquote cartoons, animated things, and have them have that tone to them. They're just afraid of it. And I don't know why, and it bugs me, and it always will.
It's funny, because it probably wouldn't be an issue if circa 1979, that wasn't the norm. Like, you did only make cartoons for kids back then, more or less. Mm-hmm. If you were making it for the first time now, I bet they'd be less gun-shy about
it. Yeah, maybe.
Yeah.
And it is sort of a children's story. I don't think it's a kid's book.
Well, it got labeled as a children's story.
Yeah.
By dint of being a cartoon, and then also instead just made children fear bunnies.
Well, and also, I mean, Netflix has shown that they're willing to take source material and take it to it's not as extremes, but be true to it. Like, we were just talking about Daredevil. Daredevil books have always been very dark and very underbelly of the comic book world, and they were not afraid of that. They embraced that. So I don't know why they're afraid here. And the only reason I'm guessing is because it's a cartoon and you got to have the kids on board. And, you know, as somebody who's a big fan of making sure your kids, you know, you're not exposing them to too much weird stuff when they're young, this isn't really for them. It never was for them. And so bring it in its full glory, Netflix, BBC.
Yeah. I really think that's the problem, is that it has the baggage of people thinking that it was for them once upon a time.
Mm-hmm.
Like, if we just started with a clean slate, like, hey, this isn't for kids, fine. But we've already kind of walked into the trap of Watership Down being for kids.
Yep.
Yeah, here's the quote. The executive producer told The Telegraph that they plan to, quote, tone down the levels of on-screen violence to make it more appropriate for children.
Oh, good. It'll be off screen so we can all imagine the horrendous things and never sleep again.
That's always the worst. Not to invoke Daredevil again, but last season when somebody got their head mushed in a car door, that was way worse because I couldn't see it. You know? And not that I want to see it either, really, but I mean, it wasn't spelled out for me. So instead, my imagination's going, oh my gosh, the pulpy mess that is this guy's head. You know, that's what happens. So very good point,
Brett.
And
then you were drawing it for days, and then you were making clay molds. And
yep. Now I associate red with the smell of Ernest Borgnine.
It reminds you of grapefruit.
Well, anyway, we'll see how it goes. I'm actually kind of excited about it. Big thanks to all our subreddit submitters today. You guys are amazing. Captain Kipper, especially you for that New York Times story. But all of you guys, IDG3, Tipadentia, am I saying that right? Probably.
Tipadacinta.
Jeff Rose.
Piscatora NF.
Piscatora NF. Laura Roman, and more. You can submit your...
ladies and gentlemen, if you could submit pronunciation guides along with your usernames at currentgeek.reddit.com, that would be fantastic. Thank you.
Do them in English. Just kidding. All right. Quick note about our Crate Joy that we do here on the show. It is just for Current Geek, and it's over at frogpants.cratejoy.com. What is it, you ask? Well, this month, for example, if you are signed up for the Crate Joy, you got shot glasses. One time only, man. Yep.
One shot.
Yep. You got one shot to get the shot glasses. Next month, the second half of this year's calendar is on its way out. There's so much more stuff in there. I can't name them all, but every month there's something unique. There's stuff from me, from Tom, from guests, all kinds of cool stuff. So sign up for it. Go over to frogpants.cratejoy.com. All the details are there. That's how we pay for this show, and it's how we bring it to you. So go do it. We'd really appreciate it. All right. Here's this little thing right here.
America scores and wins.
Okay. Oh, where's my... There we go. All right. Thank you very much. This is the sounds of a quiz show. This is when we do a little quiz with our guest. They come on the show. They answer questions about areas of their expertise. When they get answers correctly, they hear this. When they get them wrong, they hear this. And at the end, Tom scores it all and gives them points, and we see how they do on the average. Brett, are you ready for your questions?
No, I have very few areas of expertise. This is going to go horribly awry.
Five points for honesty.
Yep, that's you've already earned some points. Good job. Hold on, your thing is not coming up, which is a problem. There we go, got it. All right, that's not it. Hold on. Okay, pop quiz. There we go. Your topic is the Three Amigos film. The Three
Ready.
Amigos. All right, here is your first question. Do not be nervous. Answer to the best of your ability. First question. Who directed The Three Amigos?
Oh, geez. I actually don't know. It was produced by Lorne Michaels. Directed by... I don't know.
I'll give you a hint. No, I won't. I'll just tell you that you're wrong. And then I'll tell you that it was John Landis. John Landis.
So you get a half point production credit, but then a 3/10 of a point Lorne Green reduction. Mm. So you end up with 0.2 out of that.
A Lorne Green reduction. That's when you get fired from SNL, I guess. Here's your next question. What year is the film set in? So the setting of the film is in what year?
1920. See, it's after World War One. 1929.
1916 is the correct answer.
Oh, geez. So far off.
It's all right. I wouldn't have known. 1916 is the correct answer. Yes.
Man, who knew I was so bad at this game?
Well, we'll see. Next question. What is the profession of the Lady Luck? Sorry. Of Lady... let me start that over. What is the profession of Lucky Day, Rusty Bottoms, and Little Ned?
Oh, they're actors.
Yeah. Well, you might be right. Well, I'll give you this. It says silent film actors, but it's the same. That's what actors were then. So we'll give you that one.
You get 0.9.
Yeah. What village does El Guapo extort protection money from in the film?
Santo Poquito.
Oh, you're so... All right, Tom, you're going to have to judge on this. It's Santa Poco.
Oh, well, no, he was talking about the smaller section of Santa Poquito. So, yeah, full point. It's just a more specific answer. In fact, he gets a half point bonus on top.
Point and a half, dude. Nice job. Next one. Phil Hartman has a part in the film. Who does he play?
Does?
Yep.
Before he died.
Yeah. Yes. That's my understanding.
Hartman. Who's Phil Hartman in the movie? Was he one of the Germans? No.
I'll give you a hint. He had a name, and it only has a single syllable, and that's the only we know him from. Single syllable, single name.
Sid.
Oh, man. You're actually close. Sam is the correct answer. Sam.
Was an S word. Get a third point for one letter.
Man, when is Sam in the movie?
I don't remember. I remember him being in it.
I love this movie.
I seem to think he was early on was part of the film... company thing with John Lovitz and all that. That's my memory of that.
He was Joe Montaigne's right hand man.
Yeah, some side character like that. All right, which character sends the Three Amigos a telegram asking them for help? What's her first name?
first name is Sally.
It is Carmen. Carmen. Yeah.
You actually get a cackle of exasperation penalty there to a half point.
All right, fair enough. Next one, second to last question. What year was the film released? Like actual year.
1986.
Mm-hmm. Oh, look at that. Look at that one right there. In fact, I'll give you a nicely done. Last question. Who played El Guapo in The Three Amigos?
Was he ever in anything again?
I don't know. I've never seen this name before. I'm guessing not.
Umberto Lindquist. Right, close?
It's Alfonso Aro, or Ara, A-R-A-U, Aru.
I was in there. They both had vowels. I feel like that was pretty close.
I don't know. That was actually pretty good, and it made me laugh, too. So, Tom, I don't know how you want to score that last one, but those are your questions, and let's add it up. How did he do?
Jeez, that was hard, guys. Good work.
Look at Tom doing the math over there. I can see him ripping through it.
You ended up with a wonderful total of 8.4.
Yay!
Nice.
You know what? That's higher than most.
If
we're being honest. Oh, yeah. Yeah, people land around the 6 or so range. It also depends on Tom's mood sometimes, how people do. But you did really well, so congratulations. That is the pop quiz, everybody. You've made it through the gauntlet of pain. It's time for this.
The future promises even more startling things to come.
All right, this part of the show is dedicated to predicting the future and talking about things that may come to pass. It depends on what topic we have, but sometimes it's science, sometimes it's regular life, sometimes it's nerd stuff, whatever. I've got one for you. It's video game related, and here it is. I believe that E3 will stop. I actually talked to this on DTNS while Tom was out of town, so I'm repeating myself a little bit, but I wanted to bring it up again. I believe that E3 will eventually go away. The Electronic Entertainment Expo, as currently held in Los Angeles, California, will eventually go away. There are already big companies pulling out of it. EA no longer has floor space, which is crazy. Nintendo is not showing their new hardware there. And for the last few years, they've only done their presentation via pre-recorded video. They don't do the presentation on stage anymore. Just little by little, you're seeing it start to kind of fall apart as the internet and the world becomes a lot more connected and less reliant on a bunch of trade groups and press to go to one single event and tell us what's going on. So, in the light of that, in order to preserve the tradition of it, I think that anyone sooner than later, will be able to attend that conference and conferences like it via virtual reality, via a VR headset. There will be playable games in there. It'll all be emulated somehow. There's plenty of ways to emulate that, and you'll have the whole experience in your head. Hey, your Oculus showed up. Or no, it's a Vive.
Yeah, Scott, I'm at next year's Nerdtacular, and it's amazing.
What's it smell like in there?
Yeah, what is it? Does it smell like red, or what color?
It's a kind of a mixture of grapefruit and tea tree.
Have you hooked it all up yet? Have you been using it?
Yeah, actually, I have. And stupid things like Job Simulator are totally immersive.
Yeah, very compelling.
Like you get past the idea of like a screen door effect, and this really doesn't have a ton of field of view, and it's a little weird to see hands but feel controllers. Next thing you know, you're like, "Where's the bacon? Mm-hmm. I gotta get this order." Like the fact that it's all around you and you're moving around. The biggest thing that I've said is when you're done and you take off the helmet. A lot of people have been saying, oh, you feel it's kind of hard to get used to the real world. And for me, it's not that so much as I'm in a different part of the room than I thought I was.
Oh, wow.
Oh,
like I'm not paying attention exactly to where I am, but I start facing this way because I do it in this area right behind me. Mm-hmm. And then, I'll be doing stuff. And the next thing I take it off and I'm like way over there in the corner facing the other direction.
Wow. So the feeling of presence is working for you. You're feeling like you're in there.
Yeah, it's the kind of thing that definitely needs improvement, mm-hmm. but just the fact that I'm not used to that, there's enough presence there that I can start to feel like, okay, yes, I am in this game.
That bodes well. So what do you think about the idea of that being your window into conferences like that? And you could apply it to anything, CES or anything. Like, well, you want to look at a new LG TV, put this thing on and walk around.
It would be so much easier to move around the floor.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. You wouldn't have to go anywhere. You just sit in your underwear and do it. The amazing. Brett, what do you think?
Well,
about
yeah, and just like click to get over to the booth you want instead of having to actually walk.
Exactly. What do you think, Brett? You want to do that for
so
your next
does
big
that
con?
Mean they're still going to have to set up an E3 somewhere to photograph, or they're just going to animate it all?
It would be
good
so
question.
Then my point, so this is the future part of it, because technically right now you could render a rudimentary floor layout and you could go around and see stuff, but I think it would need to get to the point where it would be a fully rendered floor space. It wouldn't have to be based on an actual physical space. The physical space would go away. What would happen instead is the organization that makes E3 would work directly with, I don't know, let's say Blizzard, and they say, we want your latest game there. We want people to be able to play Overwatch at this thing. And what this thing would literally let you do is walk around a virtual space, go to the Blizzard presentation area, their floor space, talk to an AI or even an actual Blizzard person there who may want to help you with any questions you may have. And while you're there in the virtual space, there's a screen and a computer you could sit down to, or there's a controller or whatever. And these are things you'd be having your hands in real life or some way of emulating that. And you would see that game on screen. You would play it just like if you were sitting in front of it. That gameplay would be streamed into the world via various streaming technologies that already exist. You can do with PlayStation and Xbox One and stuff, streamed to your television and back into your computer and back and forth and all that. Just like a Steam box does or anything else. I think you would want to recreate those experiences within that world. It sounds really impractical right now, but at some point it becomes less expensive to do something like that and participate in something like that, and more of a value proposition for these companies than renting out multiple square feet of space that costs you millions of dollars every June for very little payback.
Yeah.
That's my thinking.
It sounds awesome.
Yeah.
I bet it would be something like a pendulum, because the whole idea is like that's how you get everyone's attention, and you get everyone's attention because it's a unique thing that happens once a year.
Mm-hmm.
So I would bet that like once everyone gets used to VR, they would go back to like a big budget all in one place at one time thing just to capture attention in a different way again.
Oh, plus you'd also, yeah, go ahead, Tom.
Well, I was going to say, like, Nintendo doesn't do in-person events. They do their Nintendo Direct. So this is built for that perfectly.
Yeah.
On the other hand, like you're saying, Brett, a lot of times we want to meet in person because it's different. And I'm not sure that virtual reality is going to be as good as meeting in person for a long, long time. So we want to go to these conferences a lot of times because we want to be in the same room as other people. And it's not going to replace that aspect of it. So that leaves the question, is there a benefit to the physicality of a press conference, of making people fly across the country to be at your thing, that, you know, nudges them into giving you better coverage than if you just said, oh, well, stay where you are and come in virtual reality?
Well, they're definitely.
Yeah.
They're
or
definitely,
maybe there's the big virtual reality one once a year, and then you have like 6E.5s at different points in time around the country that are way smaller. It
makes perfect sense from a, like, okay, so if we're talking about PAX or like a fan event or like a Comic-Con style event, I don't think you want to go have this anywhere near that unless you want to just sort of showcase some cool stuff about the event. But the real drive should be the physicality of having people there, because that's all about the relationships and seeing your old friends again and all that stuff. But when it comes to a closed industry style event like E3, where it is completely closed to the public can't go in there, although some sneak in, but it just seems like this would be a great way to blow it out. Maybe you still have the physicality on a lower level, a smaller auditoriums, that sort of thing for press and for industry leaders like Walmart reps and things like that. But then at home, all of us, the public Joes, can see this stuff in a new way. And I just think that if the goal is to get people jazzed about the products and the stuff on display, that would get me really excited about E3 again.
I think that's a key.
Yeah.
For a video game, this might work, because you can have a simulation of the video game. You can have a demo of the video game in the virtual reality, and it won't lose a lot.
Right.
For a product, I can't really try it in virtual reality.
Good
point. I can't pick it up. I can't work with it in real life. And that's an entirely different thing.
So like CES would be rough. Like if you wanted to look at the actual curved, new, thin 4K TV, you need to walk around that. You need to see it on. Like the whole point of that device is for you to fall in love with the device, not a virtual representation of that device. So
it's not a pipe.
Exactly. So, I don't know. I just feel like this stuff's coming. I think they're going to experiment a lot with this at some point.
For sure.
We'll, you know, if we can ever get to the fidelity where where my voice and my presence is indistinguishable outside of just that your brain knows you're not really there, but by all intents and purposes, all of what you see and all of what you hear is you being locationally based in another place, the better that gets, the more
synesthesia mask comes in.
That's right. Then you start smelling stuff. I mean, they're already making, you can go buy stuff on, well, they had Kickstarters for some of this. I don't know how available it is to the public, but there were interesting products that were attached to your Oculus dev kits that would blow scents at you, that would create mist and water and stuff, and kind of like that Disney theater where you're sitting there and everything's farting on you the whole time. What's that called?
That's just called our theater.
Bug Life. That's just called the AMC up the street. No, it's I forgot what it's. Oh, it's Honey, I Shrunk the Kids thing in Disneyland, and the whole time the chairs are rumbling and there's air coming up between your legs and there's like a.
Oh yeah, they have that. The Minions have that at Universal.
Yeah, same thing. So.
Yeah, there's quite a few of them now.
I think some of that all that sort of all, I don't know, those things that help immerse you, are going to just get better, smaller, cheaper. And then there's no reason why you couldn't do more of those kinds of experiences outside. But Tom, you're totally right. I can't go look at 3D printers in a virtual world. I need to touch them. I need to see them. I need to hold what they just printed. You know, and until
hug
I can...
them.
Yeah, I want to hug them.
Kiss them.
I want to kiss them. I want to give them sea monkeys. I want all those things.
That's probably on Urban Dictionary somewhere.
Probably.
I think we nailed it, which is there are certain kinds of events that you don't need to be there for that the virtual reality will take over for. And maybe E3 is one of those, but it won't be able
and
to
in
take
fact, there's a lot of elements of E3 that would be like greatly improved by not having to stand in line and wait for someone else to stop playing a game.
Yeah,
absolutely.
And these short little demos, I mean, you could in virtual space, everybody could have as much access as they wanted. You may still limit it because the game's not done and you'd say, well, you're only getting the first level or something. And, you know, you could have a lot of leeway as developers in that sense, but you wouldn't have to turn it off every 5 minutes and move on. Also, I don't want to demo. Here's the other thing I don't ever want to do. I don't want to demo your VR experience in a real world place. I want it to be my helmet because I don't want your pink eye. I don't mean you, Tom. I'm sure you're clean. But
really afraid of pink eye.
And listen, every time anybody I ever talk to goes to a conference and has public access to a VR experience, they all come home with pink eye. All of them.
Wow.
Really?
Yeah. A lot of them do.
Have you ever had in your life?
It's I've had it once when I was like, I don't know, in my teens. And I remember then my aunt telling me that it was poo, that there was poo in my eye. And I remember thinking, well, I'm not doing that ever again then. And then and that was just with, I don't know what it was, but when they did this study a couple of years ago and found that some local theater chain had these 3D glasses when 3D was getting pushed so much. And then when they're done with the movie, they take them to a dishwasher, run them through a dishwasher, and then make them ready for the next crowd to go in. And they would stagger them every other movie showing. And that bunch of those, even when cleaned, were covered in some kid's diaper resins. You know, like big old freaking pink eye nightmares. Oh, my gosh. It just grosses me out. Grosses me out. It's like elevators, Tom. I know how you love elevators. It's like that with me and pink eye.
Got it. Got it now.
Now
totally
you're
makes
good.
Sense.
Now you're good.
Turns out Tom hates elevators because they give him pink eye.
Yeah.
They give you pink everything.
You know, most people don't lean up against the back of the elevator like this to, you know, make themselves feel better.
Right.
But, like I thought you had to push the button with your eye. I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Of course.
No, I just don't want to see anything. So I just press my eyes.
It's like
up
a retinal scanner to get to the fourth floor.
Yeah, right.
I love it. All right. Let's get to an email. We got an email here. We get feedback all the time from people. It comes to currentgeek@gmail.com. We got one from Rich from lovely Cleveland. Oh, regular. Let's see what he has to say. So, Scott and Tom, I just realized that while the period of time between Undiscovered Country and TNG would be fertile for new story possibilities, it's also a remarkably convenient time where you could cameo some of the remaining original cast members and have them aged appropriately for the second period, or for the time period, rather, excluding Shatner, who is caught in the giant plot hole Nexus. That's a good point. I'm sure this played no part in their decision. He's talking about the TV show Rich from lovely Cleveland. Yeah, why not that time period? We learned last week, Tom, I think you're the one that said that the show would be anthology-based. It would be a different cast every week, different time period. So why not fiddle around with that sort of...
Well, not every week.
Not every week, every year, sorry.
This is a rumor, is that it would be a different storyline every year. It could even be have cast overlap, like American Horror Story does. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it wouldn't be the same story every year. And I'll even go farther. You can have Shatner. in it.
Sure.
The Nexus, the people in the Nexus exist in the Nexus forever, mm-hmm. right? It's not in time. So it would be perfectly possible to pull him out of the Nexus and have him still be in the Nexus for generations.
Plus, he doesn't get sucked into the Nexus until the beginning of Generations. There's a lot of time on...
Well, no. It's not the beginning of Generations. It's sometime after Undiscovered Country.
I thought at the very beginning
he's on the maiden voyage of the Enterprise B.
Oh, right. They're just showing like a flashback is what that was, right? Like yeah. That was a time. Okay, yeah. So yeah, whenever that was, that had no Spock in it. He wasn't in that movie, by the way. And it didn't have a couple other cast members. There's a whole chunk of time.
It had the guy from Ferris Bueller who's stealing the Enterprise from his dad.
Cameron?
Yeah, Cameron's the captain of the Enterprise B.
Captain Cameron. That's right. That actor's in there. I forgot about that. Oh, that's hilarious. Let my Enterprise go. Anyway, when they show those guys, there's a huge chunk of time between the end of Undiscovered Country and that we're not accounting for, and they're about that age.
No, you're right. But there's even more time after B, and so you're right. You could have Shatner show up before B, but he would be older. And maybe that's where Rich still has a point, is if you pull him out of the Nexus, he should be the same age he was in Generations, because nobody ages in the Nexus.
Yeah, that's true, that I know of. How about, Brett, what do you think about this whole Star Wars on TV thing, anthology series stuff? It's pretty exciting.
Even Star Trek.
Or Star Trek.
Gosh, dang it. Anything.
I keep saying Star Wars today. This is about the eighth time today I've said Star Wars when I meant Star Trek. I don't know what is wrong with me. Sorry, go ahead.
Same thing. Yeah.
I was saying that I boycott anything that has anything to do with Shatner nowadays. He beat me once in for a web video award. And
well,
I'm
he's not in this new series, but you're saying the potential for him to be is enough.
It has a stink on it. I'm out.
Well, now that he's embraced his Trekness and likes it, he used to hate it. Now he likes it. There's a better chance now than ever that he'd show up in it. So, yeah, you got to watch out. Shatner's a wily one. He'll get you every time. Big thanks for the
email,
Rich.
Still remember that day, Brett. Still remember that day.
Yeah. It was a dark day. It was a dark day.
That might be the day I met Eileen.
Oh, look at that.
Maybe you.
I think you guys met for the first time at those awards.
She works at YouTube.
A Hollywood awards show. That was the first time.
So wait a minute. Remind me, when you had a video up against his, and was the thinking that he won it because he's Shatner? And that's it?
For sure.
Okay. So there's no question. Shatner wins because he's Shatner.
There's no way that my stuff wasn't just worse than his.
No way. No possible way.
Okay. I like the sound of all of this.
I mean, personally, I don't think it was.
Okay.
I actually don't think it was, but also, like, who cares? Yeah. It was so long ago.
Whiskey under the bridge, as the country singer says. There's your email. And if you want to send us your own at home, folks, please use the email address as liberally as you like. It's currentgeek@gmail.com. We're happy to read them right here on the show. It's going to do it for us today. Before we get out of here, though, Brett's got stuff he's up to, things he's working on. We would love to know more. Where can people find your stuff?
Well, you can find me on Twitter at Amtrekker, AMTREKKER. But also, if you have an iOS device, then you should definitely go download Mission Pick, which is an awesome app where every day, everyone gets the same new mission, and then you take a photo that satisfies that mission, and then the community votes the photos up and down and creates these leaderboards of really stunning photography. And it's getting better every day. Look, Tom has it in his hands right there.
Yeah, it's awesome. Mission Pick is great.
It's ubiquitous, folks. Mm-hmm. Today's mission.
Today's mission, ubiquitous.
I think what I like about it most is you've gamified something I didn't think about. Like, I love that kind of stuff with apps. You've turned something that people are doing anyway every day and made it way more fun. Like, you've injected just a little bit of like geocaching in this, sort of. And mm-hmm. I love that gamification of photography is way, way cool.
It makes you think about the world in a different way. That's the thing that I've enjoyed when I've used it is that it's like, I'm now seeing this thing and it fits ubiquitous and now I get it. And I'm going to take a picture that I never would have taken. It's awesome.
Yeah. Listen to these reviews, like great fun, nice community, my daily addiction. This person says, fun, competitive photo sharing. So addictive. I've never had so much fun with an app. Man, it just goes on.
It's been pretty great. We have a really friendly community in there, too. It's been a fun ride, and it does make you look at the world a different way. Like, I spend all day, every day, going through, like, looking for whatever I'm looking for that day, and it was unexpectedly fun. I would honestly say when I first started building it, I thought I was building it for an audience that was not me. Mm. And was shocked that I enjoyed it so much.
Wow. That's high praise. Also, there's a candy bar in here I want to eat. Anyway, go check it out. That's Mission.
Picture of a candy bar?
Yeah, a picture of a candy bar. It looks really, really good. I don't know.
It's not a pipe.
No. It gets a number one, too. It got a ribbon. It says first place on it. Oh, so
good candy bar.
It's a really cool app. People should check it out. That's Mission Pick on the App Store. Absolutely worth your time. Tom, do you have anything else going on you'd like to mention, sir?
Yeah, go download Mission Pick, or if you already have it, go find your friend who has an iOS device and make them download it, and then you'll have more friends on Mission Pick.
I agree.
Go check it out.
And the other thing I've got going on is Pilot X. We've mentioned it previous weeks. It's my novel about a time-traveling guy who just wants to fly his time ship, gets sucked into a dimensional war, and he may be the only person who can save the universe, but he might have to kill his entire culture to do it. So if that sounds interesting to you, go to inkshares.com and please pre-order the book. The more people that pre-order, the better chance of it getting fully published. We've got about 450 people pre-ordered so far. We need 750 over the next 50 days. So if you've been thinking about it, get over there, inkshares.com, Pilot X.
Nice. There's tons going on around here. I don't even know what thing to send people to, so I won't. You know what I'll do? I'll recommend the things going on Twitch right now. There's some artwork happening there, and there's some gaming happening there. Well, not this second, because I'm recording the show with Tom, but normally there is. So if you want to write this down or bookmark it, don't write it down. Put it in your browser and then bookmark it. It's easy to go find it. It's frogpants.com/Twitch. It'll take you straight there, and come join the fun. Probably tonight be a little streaming going on. Heroes of the Storm, whatever we're in the mood for. Diablo Season 6 starts tonight, so we're playing some of that. Any chance I get, I'm all up in there. That's going to do it for us. Thanks, everybody. Voicemail, 801-471-0462. Don't forget that. You can also send your tweets and follow us on Twitter. None of that made sense. Over at Current Geek, at Scott Johnson, at Ace Detect. And currentgeek.reddit.com for the Reddit, currentgeek@gmail.com for our email address, currentgeek.com for everything else. Oh, and alphageekradio.com for simulcasting the show. Do check them out, alphageekradio.com. It's going to do it for us, for me, for Tom, and for Amtracker. We'll see you then.
Bye.
Hi, and welcome back to Legal Geek. This week, we again tackle a topic relevant to Game of Thrones and other TV fans. Spoilers. And what Google is doing in the patent world to help combat such spoilers from ruining the day of those trying to avoid them. Going back all the way to shows like The X-Files and online message boards, fans of story-based television have often wanted to experience the surprise plot twists and highs and lows of narrative without having someone tell them beforehand what's going to happen. With DVR and streaming services now making time-shifting of television the standard for many viewers, plus the omnipresent existence of social media linking us all together, spoilers have hit an all-time high in relevance. Mainstream media and the public understand this phenomenon. However, even well-meaning media outlets can make mistakes and accidental spoilers just by selecting the wrong photo to put in a Twitter post about an episode review, as was the case with a photo of Melisandre, which Slate.com initially put on Twitter this week. Can this spoiler problem be solved? Google certainly thinks so, and its patent department is riding in like a white knight with multiple patents to try and save the day. Even this week, Google was granted another in a series of patents which are innovating in ways to help avoid spoilers. Going back to 2011 and 2012, Google was first granted two U.S. patents on time-shifting messages located in forums and message boards online based on content which has not yet been reached by a user watching a TV show. In 2015, Google was granted U.S. patent 8943529, which claims a system for evaluating when a user changes the channel, whether what is on that channel contains spoilers for content yet to be viewed. Later in 2015, additional patents like U.S. patent number 9002942 were granted to Google on more broad claims covering the processing and determination of content spoilers, so that a spoiler warning can be given to pertinent users of social media or other similar technologies. Even this past week, one of the image processing and sharing technologies that Google is developing as the backbone for implementing this spoiler stopping received another granted U.S. patent. Additional applications are already published or in the works as well, which means Google is tackling the spoiler monster with a plethora of patents. If Google can make these patented technologies the new standard for content processing online, the problem of spoilers may indeed be mostly solved once and for all. Well, except for that jerk at the water cooler who speaks too loudly. The bottom line is, despite software and business method patents being on shakier ground following some recent Supreme Court decisions, the efforts of Google prove that these types of patents are not dead, especially when addressing problems like spoilers that only became very prevalent thanks to current television and social media technologies. In other words, spoilers are dead, long live spoilers. Thanks for listening. Please provide feedback and segment suggestions to me on Twitter at BuckeyeFitzy.
This show is part of the Frog Pants Network. Get more at frogpants.com.